Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. I hope you're having a great day wherever you are. It's another summer sit down. It's another week, another show, another sit down. Got a great episode planned for you today. Episode 63 is upon us. Last week was a terrific one. If you haven't checked it out, make sure you go check out episode 62 of the sit down. We had the great Scott Bernstein on, had a real nice round table. We kicked around, what does the mafia look like today in America? Went over the families, the leadership, and more. So make sure you check out that episode and all of our episodes here on the show. As always, if you enjoy the show, make sure you check us out on Twitter at the sit down 7. And if you want more great mafia content apart from the show, please go check us out on YouTube as well. The sit down, a mafia history podcast. And if you're listening to the show, it is a big week for me. I've got a lot going on in my professional life, if you will. So if you're a new listener, you're checking the show out for the first time, welcome. Where you been? Thanks for fucking being here. I'm excited about today's episode. You know, I think occasionally we always find ourselves on the sit down, or really in mob history circles, we're always looking at the big names, right? John Gotti, Vito Genovese, Vincent Gigante, Tommy Lucchese, Joe Bonanno, Joe Massino, you know, Sonny Franzese, Sammy Gravano. But it's important that we get into the crux of these families, the guys that were really making the money, they were really breaking heads, they were really bringing in massive amounts of things to these families. And today we're going to talk about, you know, the fringe guy. We're going to talk about a guy today that really is up there with the likes of Bugsy Siegel, Jimmy Burke, guys that could never be made into the mafia, but were awarded the same respect as a COPPA regime. Today, we're going to talk about a guy, Joe Watts. And if you know anything about the late, great John Gotti, the Dapper Don, Joe Watts is really an instrumental person in his life. Joe Watts is characterized really as this, a guy that could never be made, but was more respected than pretty much anyone in the family. Murderer, a guy that made tons of money, a guy that was awarded tons of respect, and really had some amazing things that happened to him during his time. We'll also get into a rumor that was started about Joe Watts, and we're also going to talk about the many indictments that Joe the German would face in his career. So sit back, relax. It's Joe Watts on the sit down. Joseph Watts was born in 1942. Now, Joe Watts' father was actually Welsh. You know, also some Italian. His mother was actually Italian. So he could never truly be made. His last name, his surname, was not Italian. So he was never going to be, you know, a Nicky Carrazzo or a Charlie Carniglia. He was never going to be a mobster. But that didn't preclude him from being a powerful guy. He would actually come up in the Gambino crime family really in the early 60s. And Joe Watts was particularly strong, at least initially, in the world of loan sharking. Joe Watts realized that, you know, and to this day, loan sharking is one of the most efficient ways to make money. One that you can make a lot doing it. There's very little oversight you really need. And if you're good with math, you have a good consumer base, and you have the ability to take care of someone that doesn't pay, you can amass a lot of money. I mean, loan sharking is free money. Think of it like this. Let's say you give someone $2,000. The general thought on a $2,000 loan is you are going to, at the end, for 10 weeks, pay $260. That's the payment that you would give to Joe Watts. Let's say you take $2,000 from Joe Watts. Every week for 10 weeks, Joe Watts is every week going to collect $260 from you. And in the end, Joe Watts is going to get his original $2,000 out, but he's also going to make $600 off the top. So think about this. Think of Joe Watts as 100 customers, and he makes 600 on each customer. That's a 10-week period. That's about 2 months. So let's say he has 600 customers. He has 100 customers at basically, you know, 600. Let me say this again. I'm confusing myself here. He makes $600 of 100 customers. Okay, so he'll make 60 grand. Okay, that's every, let's just say, 2 months. So basically for a quarter, you know, a calendar year. I mean, Joe Watts is going to bring in millions of dollars just loan sharking. You could make and survive just strictly all that. That's just one racket. Now, remember, Joe Watts is going to have way more than 100 people, and he's going to have much more than just $600. He's giving out $5, $10, $20, $50,000. It was incredibly adept for Joe Watts. He was able to make money. And this is where he would also develop the ability that you wouldn't fuck with Joe Watts. And again, loan sharks would find that out. Loan shark customers would find that out by not paying him. This is where he developed a fearsome reputation as well. By the 70s, Joe Watts was starting to afford a lot of respect. And as we know in the Gambino crime family, by the early 70s, Carlo Gambino was in control of the Gambino crime family. He has allotted the control. He changes the name, and it's the Gambino crime family. The good thing for him, he establishes his cousin as his heir apparent, Paul Castellano. And Joe Watts had a particularly strong reputation with Paul Castellano. By the 70s, though, Joe Watts would start to encounter some concerns. One night in a bar in Staten Island, Joe Watts would encounter an individual, Jerry Chili. Now, Jerry Chili, in his own right, was a lunatic. If you know anything about Jerry Chili, just kind of describe who Jerry Chili is. Jerry Chili was a plump, short little guy that wore glasses, looked like a fucking mobster, always had a cigar in his mouth, wore the tracksuits, just looked like a individual you didn't want to mess with, had a mouth on him. He loved to drink. He loved to gamble. He loved to take drugs. He was a lunatic in all sense. So one night in a bar, Joe Watts walks in, and Jerry Chili and him get into this argument at the bar. And according to onlookers, Joe Watts was, quote, verbally assaulted. Jerry Chili went into one of his expletive rants, and they got into an argument. Joe Watts is furious that he's basically disrespected in front of everybody in the bar. Joe Watts goes directly to Paul Castellano. Remember, by this point, Paul knew who he was. He was kicking up to Paul. He was a guy that the brass knew. Paul Castellano is basically told by Joe Watts, I want Jerry Chili fucking dead, okay? And on the surface, you would think that'd be crazy. How the fuck does an associate think he has the ability, who's not even made, to have a made guy whacked? But this is the kind of respect that Joe Watts had. Paul Castellano orders Neil Delacroce to deal with this. Neil Delacroce would go to Jerry Chili, his oversight, which would be Alphonse Sonny Red and Delicato. He was kind of in control at the time. He was a capo regime who kind of oversaw people like Mr. Chili. Neil Delacroce goes to Sonny Red and says, look, he disrespected our guy. This guy makes a lot of money for us. We want him fucking dead. You know, Sonny Red responds with basically, look, Joe, we're not killing a guy over an associate. Neil would respond with, quote, then shelve the fucking guy. And by shelve means you're banished from the family. And Sonny Red would actually banish Jerry Chili from the family. That's the kind of respect Joe Watts had already developed. Remember, by this point, Joe Watts is not an old man. He's in his early 30s. But the money he was making, the respect he was given by guys like Paul Castellano, it was unfathomable. Now, Jerry Chili would ultimately be shelved for this. Now, for Jerry Chili, he wouldn't stay shelved forever. Gerardo Chili would actually resurface after the three capos hit. And he would actually work under a guy, Patty from the Bronx, DiFilippo, a capo out of the Bronx and the Bonanno crime family. At one point, Jerry Chili would be caught on wiretap, basically telling the guys in Queens to go fuck themselves. Jerry Chili will probably do a show on at some point. He was his own one-man crime wave, if you will. But again, we're developing the respect that Joe Watts had and, you know, just was that kind of guy. Obviously, in 1976, Carlo Gambino would die of natural causes, and Paul Castellano would take over. Now, Joe Watts had a lot of allegiance to Paul. Paul was really the guy that took him from being just an associate that was a loan shark to really a respected guy. And he would always be kicking up envelopes. And one thing we know about Paul, if you were kicking up envelopes to him, you were always going to be in his good graces. Paul was at the White House by now, and a certain member in Queens was figuring out that, you know, for him, he was going to do what he had to do. As we know, by the mid-80s, there was a young person in the Gambino crime family, John Gotti, that was making it clear that Paul Castellano was a hypocrite. People were coming disillusioned with Paul's leadership. He was greedy. He was hypocritical. And what do we know happens? In 1985, John Gotti orders the hit on Paul Castellano. Now, it's important to realize Joe Watts was actually a part of that assassination. We did a video on, in fact, a podcast on the assassination of Paul Castellano. And if you want to hear that show, it was around December of 2021, we did that show. If you remember, just a couple of refreshers, the shooters in that shooting, the shooters that hit Paul were John Carniglia and Vinny Artuso. The individuals that shot Tom Bellotti were Eddie Leno and Salvatore Scala. Now, there were backup shooters that were on 2nd and 3rd Avenues. One of the backup shooters was Joseph Watts. Okay. Now, the indication from Gotti was, now remember, this was a Castellano guy, but to win Joe Watts over, John Gotti says basically, listen, Joe, you go along with this, you participate in this, we get fucking Paul out of the way, and we will give you Tommy Bellotti's black loan book. Now, for anyone that doesn't know what I mean by that, remember how much money Joe Watts was making with his own loan shark customers. Now he's going to get the infusion of one of the biggest loan shark customer books in really the mob. So Joe Watts was going to become a very rich individual by doing this. Usher out old news and bring new news in. Now Joe Watts becomes a very rich man. He begins purchasing mansions, one of which was a mansion in the very trendy Casey Key Island in Sarasota, Florida. At one point, Casey Key would be regarded as Treasure Island due to the beautiful homes. Joe Watts creates this incredible, incredible palatial pad. I mean, it had huge walls and Doberman pinchers, and it was just a beautiful place. And Joe Watts continued to gain massive respects in the Gambino crime family. At one point, it was alleged that John Gotti didn't know how to dress before he met Joe Watts. And I've talked to colleagues of mine who talk regularly to Mikey Scars Di Leonardo. And Mikey Scars would talk about that. Joe Watts was the best dressed man in Cosa Nostra. And he taught John Gotti, this is what you wear, this is what you don't wear. And Joe Watts almost acted like a personal stylist for John Gotti. And in fact, Michael Di Leonardo would actually talk about in a recent interview with RJ Roger at Black Hamperit Mafia, he would talk about Joe Watts would go to a clothing store called Take Six. It was a very trendy clothing store owned by Arabs in New York City. And John Gotti would never like people wearing the same ties as he did. And he would go into these tie stores and he would purchase ties, Joe Watts would, for John Gotti. And he'd purchase, let's say, 10 or 12 at a time. He would take 11 of the 12 and throw them out so no one could buy them. And John Gotti would get that tie. So Joe Watts and John Gotti were trendy motherfuckers. They were dapper guys. And remember, John Gotti didn't dress like this before Joe Watts. At one point, Mikey Scars would say he was the most underrated guy in the history of the mob when speaking about Joe Watts. But by 1989, as the Gotti organization continues to become one of the most powerful in the country, the mob is in its heyday. In 1989, though, Joe Watts would start taking upon murders for the Gambino crime family. At one point, an individual called Tommy Spinelli needs killed. Now, Tommy Spinelli was the cousin of Gambino heavyweight Jimmy Brown Failure. And in certain liaison roles, Joe Watts finds out through Jimmy Brown that Tommy Sparrow might be a rat. And Joe Watts is told by Sammy Gravano and Jimmy Brown to kill Tommy Spinelli. That's exactly what he did. Now, ultimately, this would be a problem for Joe Watts because, as we know, Sammy Gravano would become an informant. Now, for Jimmy Brown would actually die in prison due to Sammy Gravano's testimony. This put Jimmy Brown away, and he ended up dying because of it. And this would be one of the murders that Joe Watts would have to face here in a bit. And we're going to get into what would ultimately happen. Also, in 1987, I want to talk about another murder that Joe Watts allegedly participated in. Around that time, remember, John Gotti had just taken over in 1985. By 1987, John Gotti was still doing business at the Bird and Hunt and Fish Club. One day, John is holding court at Bergen. It was the middle of the day. It hadn't been too long since he had orchestrated the Castellano hit. One day, they're out in front, and they hear what sounded like a gunshot, right? And they see an individual running away from the Bergen. This person, William Ciccone, he's running away from the Bergen. At that point, Bergen crew members, including Joe Watts, chase after this individual. They then abduct him and take him to a sweet shop, a candy store, in New Dorp, Staten Island. Now, this would be the last time William Ciccone would be seen. The feds would allege that Mr. Ciccone was not only shot in the head, but tortured. And at one point, the feds claimed that Joe Watts would call Gotti and say, look, I don't know if this guy's the guy. All he's talking about is religious shit. And John Gotti would supposedly respond, quote, kill him. Now, ultimately, we would find out that Mr. Ciccone was this religious fanatic, like a loner of sorts. And in a Capisci column years later, it was actually discussed that no gun was actually fired in the direction of Gotti that day. And in fact, it may have just been a truck backing up and the tire screech sounded like a gunshot. Now, Joe Watts would ultimately have to face a jury in multiple alleged murders. And this would be really the first major problem for Joe Watts. Now, as I said earlier, Sammy Gravano would ultimately become an informant at one point and would start spilling his guts about the mafia. And look, Joe Watts had to deal with the issues because of it. Joe Watts would have to face, a jury on the Tommy Spinelli hit. Around the early 90s, Sammy Gravano cooperates. And as I said, Jimmy Brown is hemmed up in that case. He basically gets 7 years on a murder conspiracy. And so does Joe Watts. Joe Watts gets involved there as well. He actually has to face a jury. He would hire F. Lee Bailey. F. Lee Bailey, as we know, was one of the attorneys that actually represented O.J. Simpson at one point. So he was kind of busy what was it, 1995-ish. But at that point, he would actually have the ability at one point. He thought once the O.J. Simpson trial ended, he believed that he would have to and would be available to cross-examine Sammy Gravano. The problem for F. Lee Bailey was in early 1996, Joe Watts would actually enter a guilty plea in the role of getting rid of Tommy Spinelli. He actually didn't actually kill Spinelli. He would farm it out to someone else and would actually dispose of Tommy Sparrow's body. Now, for this guilty plea, Joe Watts was actually given 6 years in federal prison. So he would pack his bags and head off to federal prison. Now, in 2001, he was scheduled for release. The problem for Joseph Watts was the feds do what they do. They hit him with indictment just before his release. Now, this would come back from a money laundering case that the feds would bring against Joe Watts. Pretty much what it had to deal with was his ostentatious purchase of a mansion in Casey Key, Sarasota, Florida. And what the feds said is he used loan shark proceeds to money launder through two businessmen, and they in turn purchased the home. What the feds talked about was an individual called Anthony DeSimone. He was an art dealer in New York. He was basically the go-between for loan sharking proceeds, and he would actually purchase the home for Joe Watts. Now, by this point, it was alleged that Joe Watts had committed up to 10 homicides for the mafia, you know, ones like Tommy Spinelli and William Ciccone. So the feds were hoping that they could get Joe Watts on the big charges, but they were just trying to keep him in jail. Because remember, for the previous 5 or so years, he had been in prison on the Tommy Sparrow conspiracy. So they, before he gets out, hit him with another case. And, you know, he believes that he's going to not ever get out of jail, and he's going to have to go back for another series of time inside. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. Joe Watts would get hit with another sentence in 2002. Mr. Watts would get 6 years in prison after filtering the $2 million in loan sharking proceeds to a bank in Sarasota, Florida. So he basically faced over a decade for two separate cases. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about something that we would find out in one of his cases. During the second case, we would find out something very interesting about Joe Watts. Joe Watts, by this point, had an ex-wife, a beautiful buxom blonde called Lorette Marone. Now, Miss Marone, at one point, the government wanted her to discuss her relationship with Mr. Watts. And according to AmericanMafia.com, it was uncovered that she was a matchmaker, if you will. Okay. They had been married since 1980. They had about a 16-year marriage. Once she divorced him in 1996, Miss Marone owned a company called Angels Couples. And what Angels Couples was a wife swapping website. And what she did was she would set up parties for lavish guests and different businessmen and just regular people. And they would pay a certain amount of money and you'll be able to swap partners, orgies, if you will. It would say that on the website, you could donate $80 to attend the orgy. And also there were photos of her, hanging all over men, and that this is where you go to meet judges, doctors, and even school teachers at her events. She would describe herself as a 5'8", blonde hair, brown eyes, athletic in stature with legs up to there. And it would also say that she would book swanky hotel rooms and put these little shindigs on. She would also rent yachts and even have parties in her New Jersey mansion. She would again charge $80 to attend the romp, but that, quote, single males were not allowed to attend. It was only for, couples. Now, the hotel that she would have these stays at, this Park Avenue Hotel in New York, the manager, Joseph Kaminsky, would say, quote, "It was shocking for us to read in your newspaper what went on." He would also tell them that on June 23rd, that a reservation was for a, quote, cocktail party, and that the events would take place in the Hotel DeMonaco's presidential suite, which included three large rooms, a dance floor, a living room, and a dining room. That affair would include free shooters of alcohol, a DJ, and a lovely bartender to wet you, and that there would be a, quote, person called Big Don for security. So Miss Marone had a legitimate business. She would say that no single men were allowed, like I said, and that men unaccompanied by women were barred from parties. It would also be noted that, quote, swinging does not always mean sex, but include voyeurism, exhibitionism, soft touching, and petting. So what she was protecting herself was, this is not paying for sex. This is just to meet people, and whatever happens, happens between consenting adults. And that she admitted that she had been a swinger for the past 5 or 6 years. Now, that's interesting because, as we discussed, was this before or after her relationship with Mr. Watts? My guess is, from the dates, it was likely that she had this interest during their relationship. But I have to think, if I know Joe Watts the way I think I do, I highly doubt Mr. Watts was allowing this to go on. This was something that she started doing in her liberal status after her relationship with Mr. Watts. But back to Joe Watts. Joe Watts would serve out his time and was released in the mid-2000s. Now, for Joe Watts, the continued assault on him going to prison would not stop. By this point, John Gotti was dead. John Gotti Jr. was out of the way. Peter Gotti had been arrested. The Gambino crime family looked a lot different. But again, the feds would bring up an old hit that Joe Watts was a part of on behalf of Mr. Gotti. In 1989, John Gotti had set up the murder of a guy, Fred Weiss. Now, Fred Weiss was this bon vivant on Staten Island. He was this construction magnate. He ran a sanitation business. And at one point, John Gotti urged Mr. Weiss that they needed to speak, and Mr. Weiss didn't show up. And they also believed that Fred Weiss was a government rat. So John Gotti orders Joe Watts to be a part of one hit party, and another hit party involved members of the Cavalcanti crime family in New Jersey. One faction was supposed to go to his home and stake out his home. Joe Watts would go to his apartment that he had. It just happened to be that the Jersey hit party found Fred Weiss and murdered him. Fred Weiss would be found in a truck outside his home at one point. Now, Joe Watts in 2009 would be arrested for being involved in this hit. And the problem for Joe Watts was, again, he had to face a jury. So let's kind of put this into perspective. From the early 90s, really until about a year or two ago, Joe Watts spent all of his time in prison. He would get admonished time and time again for old crimes. And what basically the feds proved was Joe Watts didn't commit this crime, but he committed the conspiracy to kill Fred Weiss. So while he didn't do it directly, he participated in the participation of the murder. At one point, the judge in the case, Judge McMahon, would call the murder heinous, hideous, and the work of a cold-blooded killer. According to Preet Bharara, a U.S. attorney would say, today's sentence should serve as a sober reminder that if you kill or harm an actual or potential government witness, no matter how powerful you may think you are, we will find you and you'll be sent to prison for a long time. Now, Joe Watts would ultimately get 13 years in this conspiracy to commit murder. Now, some other interesting things will come out in not only this sentence, but what would happen during some other things Joe Watts was engaged in. At one point, Joe Watts was admonished by the judge in this case after he was involved with a bizarre kind of involvement with a person called Abe Berger. Now, during some of his time on the street, Joe Watts came into contact in prison with an individual called Abe Berger. And once he got out of prison, he continued to communicate with Mr. Berger. Now, Abe Berger was, according to himself, a wizard at picking stocks. And any great businessman like Joe Watts thought he was going to take some of his ill-gotten gains and hopefully make more money through the stock market. Now, Joe Watts's lawyer, Gerald Chargell, would say that Mr. Berger took $400,000 of Joe Watts's money and claimed to invest it in the stock market, and that he would make all this profit for Joe Watts. At one point, Joe Watts found out that Mr. Berger actually wasn't good at picking stocks and kind of just blew all his money. Now, any good citizen would just report Mr. Berger to police. Now, as we know, mobsters don't do that. Even though Joe Watts was never a made man, he was a mob guy. At the end of the day, he was a hitman and a mobster. Joe Watts and an associate found out where Mr. Berger was. An attempt to get back his investment assaulted Mr. Berger at some point. You know, he slaps him around, beats him up, and that was that. Now, during the sentencing of this other crime, the judge in this case, Ms. McMahon, would say, quote, Mr. Watts can't just beat someone up. You should, quote, bring a lawsuit or call the cops. So, you know, and his attorney would say that he just slapped him around. He was upset. You know, I doubt that Mr. Berger will be walking the streets if Mr. Watts was the person that he claims to be. So they try to cover it up and say, yeah, well, he kind of slapped around a little bit, but there was a reason he did that. He took all his money. Now, I will say, I mean, Mr. Berger was a scumbag. And I think the one maybe good thing Joe Watts probably did was slapped around a Berger, because he definitely, you know, should have been slapped around. But she also would call Joe Watts, you know, basically a killer in that he belonged in prison. Now, for Joe Watts, he would actually serve his sentence and would, you know, serve it down in Maryland at FCI Cumberland. He would serve his sentence and be released from prison and a halfway house in January of 2022. So he did about 10 more years. So from early 90s until basically this year, you know, Joe Watts was for the most part in prison. There were a couple of months and a year or so where he got out and he was running the streets a little bit. But for the most part, Joe Watts has never fully been brought to justice. Joe Watts has done long prison sentences, but the truth is the government was never able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Joe Watts killed anyone. They got him on conspiracy to commit murder and pleas and stuff, but they never got him on murder one, which is a major failure really for the government, not only in his case, but other members of the Gambino crime family, including a guy like Mickey Boy Paradiso. It's alleged that Mickey Boy killed multiple people. Government's never been able to prove it, though. Now, I want to go back just quickly to, remember I told you guys about the murder of William Ciccone back in 1987, the guy that supposedly shot at John Gotti. Joe Watts was actually charged with that crime. He would actually be acquitted, though, of that crime. And the government felt they had enough in the testimony of government witness and former member Dominic Fat Don Borghese. According to Borghese, Watts would drive Ciccone from Queens to Staten Island in his Benz, and that Borghese would testify that he knows for a fact that Watts shot Ciccone in the head five times. Now, I guess according to the government, they didn't believe Mr. Borghese, and Joe Watts would actually be acquitted of that case. Now, if Joe Watts is found guilty of that murder, he would have got life and he would die in prison. But Joe Watts, as far as I know, is a free man. Now, Joe Watts is very old at this point. He's 80 years old. Is he in the mafia still at this point or engaged in mafia business? I have no idea. As I said, Joe Watts is not a member of the mafia. He's an associate of the mafia. Now, is he one of the most powerful people if he is involved still? Yeah, he is. Joe Watts has, for his entire career, been one of the most effective non-Italian mobsters of all time. He made millions of dollars. He killed a lot of people. He had the respect of Carlo Gambino, Paul Castellano, John Gotti, and many high-ranking members of the mob. Before I get into a great story about Joe Watts, I want to talk about a video that was recently discussed on the channel of former Gambino underboss and mob rat, Sammy the Bull Gravano. On Sammy's YouTube channel, he has contended multiple times that Joe Watts is actually a government informant. And I generally don't talk about things like this. It is important to realize when you call someone a rat, you need proof that Joe Watts or someone is a rat. And the way you find if someone is a rat is through something called a 302 document. A 302 document involves, basically, it's an interview process that the government goes through. It's called an FD-302. Basically, the government uses it to memorialize an interview where an individual decides that they want to provide testimony. An FBI agent will take notes during the witness interview. And in the interview, you have to provide the things that went on. And this is a government document that is displayed in trials. Now, here's how we, A, either know that Joe Watts is or isn't a witness. Now, if Joe Watts is still a witness, it's likely that we would not see this document. Now, the thing is, if he isn't and has never been a witness, we'll never see it. Now, here's why I don't think Joe Watts is a rat. First of all, just the things that I know about Joe Watts. Also, there's been no 302s produced that Joe Watts is an informant. You can't just kick around that someone's an informant without any, proof of it. Now, there is a 1996 article written by Jerry Capisci on ganglandnews.com that Joe Watts is an informant. Now, again, there has been no 302s. In the article written by Capisci, he would say, quote, "A one-time lieutenant of John Gotti lived a dangerous double life as a mob mole for the FBI. Joe Watts' lawyer at one point would say, Joe Watts absolutely denies being an informer for anybody, and now he's facing 25 years to life. Now, we can contend that Joe Watts has ultimately never been convicted and has served prison time, but no truly long prison time, and maybe this is the reason why. I don't believe Joe Watts is a rat. In fact, if he was, we would have proof of that through 302s, which we don't have. We've heard a lot of this stuff. I mean, a year or so ago, the New York Daily News reported that Carmine Persico was a rat. It was doctored bullshit. Sammy Gravano, I think, as usual, is trying to shift blame and try to damage people's names. There is no proof of it. As we've talked about time and time again, there is a 302 session involving John Gotti Jr. There's a 302 session involving Anthony Casso. There's a 302 session involving Sammy Gravano. There's a 302 session involving any informant that we've ever seen in the mafia. There's none involving Joe Watts. Before we wrap up Joe Watts, I want to tell an interesting story about the kind of guy Joe Watts was and the kind of guy that just did what he did. According to a book by John Gotti Jr., I want to kind of talk about a story that he would talk about in that book. The book is called In the Shadow of My Father. He would talk about an incident involving John Gotti and Frank Sinatra. At one point, John Gotti gets tickets to a performance for Frank Sinatra at Carnegie Hall in New York. And they were going to have dinner and watch the performance and then, meet up after. Frank Sinatra, from what I've found out and in the book, cancels at some point their performance. Supposedly he's sick and has an illness and he can't do the show. He cancels last minute. So John Gotti and Joe Watts go to a place called the Savoy Grill. They're sitting there, they're having dinner, when who should walk in but Sinatra, and he's with his guy, Jilly Rizzo. John Gotti's furious. that motherfucker, I can't believe he would stand me up, and then he's going to walk into this restaurant like nothing's wrong. He sends Watts over to Sinatra's table. At that point, Joe Watts proceeds to tear Sinatra a new asshole, and Jilly Rizzo too. At one point in the conversation, Joe Watts says to Frank Sinatra, quote, "The next time John sends for you and you make an excuse, I'll be the last face you'll see on earth." And he walked away. That's the kind of guy Joe Watts was. He was awarded respect. He was a snappy dresser. He was a guy that made millions of dollars. He was a guy that murdered people. He was a guy that emerged respect from the biggest names in the mafia. There was no one bigger, really, outside of maybe Meyer Lansky and Jimmy Burke over Joe Watts. And when we look back on mafia history, when we're talking about the guys that were not true mob-made men, these guys were given way more umbrage than most people, 80% of the mafia probably. Joe Watts, to this day, is a mob legend. But he's also a mob killer and a deranged lunatic. As I said, we have no idea what Joe Watts is up to now, but he is just another tale of a very interesting person from the mob, a mafia family. Before we go, I want to tell you, as always, make sure you check out The Sit Down on Twitter, at The Sit Down 7. You can also check us out on YouTube. Just search The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. So that's that. I hope you enjoyed this video or this interview, this show on Joe Watts. I always think people are watching me. This is an audio podcast. I want to thank everybody for checking us out. I know I thank people a lot on this show, but I continue to be fascinated with how many people listen to this show. And I know we're slowly turning into one of the best in the space. And I hope we continue to be that. Make sure you check out next week. We'll have another great episode. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.